From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, David Bowie on his life and music. Last year, he celebrated the 30th anniversary of the album featuring his alter ego Ziggy Stardust, which helped define glam rock and turn Bowie into a superstar. Now, Bowie has a new CD. Also, satirist Harry Shearer. He's currently on tour with the cast of A Mighty Wind. The mockumentary about folk music is also out on DVD next week. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Anything Else, the new Woody Allen film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Hurricane Isabel's winds have died down considerably as the storm approaches Canada. Isabel is blamed for at least 17 deaths in six states since making landfall yesterday on North Carolina's Outer Banks. It moved across Virginia, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania today as winds eased to around 35 miles an hour. In Baltimore, tidal flooding forced rescue crews to remove residents of a historic harborside neighborhood by boat. Baltimore Gas and Electric spokeswoman Rose Kendig says repair crews have a lot of work to do.
We have tree limbs that have fallen on transformers and damaged them. We have poles down, wires down. We have 3,000 utility personnel out in the field working round the clock, 16-hour shifts in order to get customers restored.
In Washington, D.C., it was another day off for federal workers as cleanup continues around the nation's capital. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
Isabel's strong winds blew down tree limbs all over Washington, even on the north lawn of the White House. Trees were knocked onto houses in more than 20 areas of the city, and there's still no power for thousands of residents. 350,000 federal employees were told to stay home for a second straight day. Washington's Director of Emergency Management, Peter LaPorte, says it's a mess.
It's going to be a significant cleanup. If you don't need to come in the city, please don't.
City officials say they're most concerned about flooding along the Potomac River, especially over the weekend. On the positive side, Reagan National Airport and Washington subway system have reopened. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
A federal appeals court says it will reconsider an earlier decision to postpone California's October 7th recall election. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals says it will convene an 11-member panel to consider the timing of the election. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
The appeals court didn't comment on the merits of the case, but said it would hear arguments on Monday. Earlier this week, a three-judge panel of the court postponed the election, ruling that faulty punch card ballots used in six California counties would disenfranchise as many as 40,000 voters. Governor Gray Davis in Los Angeles, appearing with former Vice President Al Gore, said momentum against the recall is growing.
And my attitude is, let's just get it over with. Let's just have this election on October 7th, put this recall behind us, so we can get on with governing in the state of California.
Speaking to a crowd of African-American voters, Gore drew comparisons between his 2000 presidential election dispute and the California recall. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Los Angeles.
JetBlue Airways is apologizing to passengers for sharing millions of passenger itineraries with a defense contractor. The airline sent an email to customers saying it made a mistake and won't do it again. JetBlue is under fire for violating its own privacy policy. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 14 points. The Nasdaq was off 4. The S&P 500 down 3. This is NPR News. The man who served as Saddam Hussein's defense minister is now in custody. Sultan Hashim Ahmed turned himself in after being promised he would be treated with respect. From Mosul, NPR's Emily Harris reports.
The negotiations took weeks and involved many different people. Finally this morning, after breakfast with his family, Saddam's former defense minister met U.S. General David Petraeus. According to people at the surrender, they chatted for a while, then Petraeus took Ahmed by helicopter to Baghdad for questioning. A human rights activist who was key in the negotiations says the U.S. promised not to prosecute Ahmed. U.S. officials say they promised to treat Ahmed well and hear his story. As Army Chief of Staff, Ahmed helped negotiate the first Gulf War ceasefire with U.S. General Norman Schwarzkopf. He became Iraq's defense minister in 1995. During the war this year, he appeared on television, calling President Bush a criminal and promising U.S. and U.K. troops would be slaughtered in Iraq's cities. It's unclear how long Ahmed will be held. Emily Harris, NPR News, Mosul.
A bomb went off in central Baghdad today. Nobody was hurt. Officials say an explosive went off in a garbage can. The explosion was heard 2.5 miles away. The head of the World Bank says U.S. estimates on how much it will cost to rebuild Iraq appear to be close to accurate, but James Wolfensohn says he's waiting to hear from Iraqis themselves before releasing the World Bank's assessment. U.S. officials say reconstruction could cost as much as $75 billion over the next 3 years. The richest got even richer this year. Forbes magazine says the total net worth of America's wealthiest people rose 10%. Microsoft founder Bill Gates is on top of the list with $46 billion. Investor Warren Buffett is still number two with $36 billion. I'm Frank Stasio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, whose magazine FFR presents new thinking about balancing the demands of jobs and family life on the web at fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. David Bowie's new album is called Reality, but he's probably better known for Surreality, inhabiting strange alter egos in his early work. His best-known character, Ziggy Stardust, mixed androgyny and science fiction. He wore elaborate eye makeup and lipstick and dyed his hair bright red. Before Ziggy, Bowie had become an icon of glam rock after posing on the cover of his 1970 album, The Man Who Sold the World, wearing a gown and makeup. As rock critic Ken Tucker wrote in the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, in the face of the hippie era's sincerity, intimacy, and generosity, Bowie presented irony, distance, and self-absorption. His song Changes announced the arrival of a new counterculture. In Bowie's career, each album seemed to find him in a different persona, with a new sound to match each new look. Let's listen to a track from his latest CD. This is Days.
Hold me tight, keep me cool. Going mad, don't know what to do. Do I need a friend? Well, I need one now. All the days of my life.
Terry spoke with David Bowie last year and asked him if having an alter ego to go with the new CD is less important than it used to be.
I think much has been made of this alter ego business. I mean, I actually stopped creating characters in 1975, for albums anyway. The only time that I've adopted characterization again since that point for my own albums has been an album called Outside that I did with Brian Eno a few years ago, which really had a myriad, maybe one too many characters, but had a lot of characters on that, and I played all the parts. But that was done as a sonic, theatrical piece of music. But the character thing really is sort of, for me personally, rather ancient history. But it's kind of, I guess over here specifically in America, the soundbitey thing really kind of stays around, and you're known by the... You're defined by the two or three things that the largest amount of people know about, and that kind of is who you are publicly. And mine is really Ziggy Stardust, characters, Let's Dance. That's me in the American, frankly, in the American eye. But in fact, in Europe, I'm more kind of this bloke what writes lots of stuff. And I kind of, I guess, a greater number of the 26 or so albums that I've made are known in Europe than they are in America.
Well, will there be a video for the new CD?
No.
Do you feel like you're past the MTV age?
Oh, I think I was past the MTV when I hit 45, you know. I mean, I was lucky to get away with them then. I think, you know, you have to kind of face reality. And for me, radio and TV play for a younger generation, which is what radio and TV are aimed at in terms of music. Are really not part of, are not going to be part of my life. So I have to rely, and many artists of my age have to rely on word of mouth. And I have very supportive fellow musicians, contemporaries and peers, and really young ones as well, who continually really speak out for me, which has been great.
How is your sense of yourself as a performer different now at the age of 55 than it was when you were in your 20s and getting started and being, when you were in persona and doing the whole, you know, eye makeup and dyed hair and dresses when you wanted
to? That was for 18 months, actually.
Right.
Which out of a career of nearly 40 years is not very long. However, I'll answer your question. I'm not actually a very keen performer. I like putting shows together. I like putting events together. In fact, everything I do is about the conceptualizing and realization of a piece of work, whether it's the recording or the performance side. And kind of when I put the thing together, I don't mind doing it for a few weeks, but then, quite frankly, I get incredibly bored. Because I don't see myself so much as a performer. I mean, I don't live for the stage. I don't live for an audience.
Can I stop you and say that I'm really surprised to hear that?
Most people are.
Yeah, because I always thought of you as somebody who really relished the theater aspect of performance and who very successfully made theater a part of music performance.
Frankly, if I could get away with not having to perform, I'd be very happy. It's not my favorite thing to do. As I say, I don't mind trying it out and making sure something seems to work well. But I really do rather want to move on, because I think it's rather a waste of time endlessly singing the same songs every night for a year. And it's just not what I want to do. What I like doing is writing and recording and much more on on that creative level. It's fun interpreting songs and all that, but I wouldn't like it as a living.
I've read about something that I'm sure a lot of people have asked you about, which is that when you were 16, you were in a fight that blinded you in one eye and I think paralyzed the muscle. I have no idea, though, what happened in the fight. Did you typically get into a lot of fights when you were that age, or was this an unusual development?
I was 13, not 16.
Oh, okay.
And it was my best friend hit me because I'd pulled his girlfriend. So I think probably in his mind he had every right to do that.
How horrifying was it?
The greatest thing. Well, it was very uncomfortable. the best thing part of it, of course, is that we still remain very close friends. And I can't remember, it must be, 40 years later.
What were you listening to when you were a teenager?
It was so... I think the only music I didn't listen to was country and western, and that holds to this day. It's much easier for me to say the kind of music I didn't listen to was pretty much that. I mean, everything from jazz to classical to popular.
Mm-hmm.
And Tibetan horns were a great part of it in 1966, 67. I love Tibetan horns.
You said that...
I still love Tibetan horns. I think Tibetan horns are one of the most wonderful sounds in the world, and Tibetan chanting. Uh-huh. It's great.
You've named Anthony Newley as one of your influences.
Oh, hugely. Not the Anthony Newley you know, probably.
Who can I turn to, Anthony Newley?
Well, yes and no. I mean, he kind of kept on singing that song when he came to America, but his whole life changed. Everything about him changed when he came to America. I think it seems that he would like to have become very much part of the Rat Pack or all that.
Right.
Las Vegas thing. But in Britain, he was kind of something else before he came to the States. And he had a stirring, a magical television series called This Very Strange World of Gurney Slade, which was really one of the most extraordinary existential comedy things that could have been seen in those years. Most of the tapes have been lost, needless to say, by the BBC, but I do have one show. There is one show that remains from really quite a short series because it was thought of as too weird for British television. He did an awful lot of things like that that were kind of strange and odd. And I liked his approach to what he was doing. He was trying to widen his own field, I think. But he kind of gave up on all that when he came to the States, because I think it was just harder to do that kind of thing in America. It has to be a lot more simple over here. And or rather less convoluted. It had to be more clearly defined in the States, because it's such a large population over here.
Did you grow up thinking of yourself as a singer, or did you start singing because you wanted to sing, you know, because you wanted to perform?
No, what I wanted to do when I was 9 years old, I wanted to be the baritone sax player in the Little Richard Band. I probably also wanted to be black at that particular time as well. So I got my father to help me out with a saxophone, and we bought it over like a 2-year period. We had something in Britain then called the hire purchase system, or HP, and I bought it on HP, which is like you pay 2 and 6 pence a week.
Oh, buying it on time.
Yeah, over like 1,000 years. So in the end, it cost you maybe twice as much as if you could have afforded cash.
Right.
And I started playing around with local rock bands, you know, with the alto. And then, in a nutshell, somebody fell ill one night, the lead singer in one of the bands, and they knew I could sing, so they asked me if I would stand up. And I quite enjoyed it, actually, I must say, at 14. It was a real trip, you know, to have girls wave at you and smile and everything just because you opened your mouth and sang. I really wanted to do more than anything else up until I was around 16, 17, was write musicals.
Was write music?
Musicals.
Oh, musicals.
I really wanted to write musicals. That's what I wanted to do more than anything else. Because I like rock music, I kind of moved into that sphere, somehow thinking that somewhere along the line I'd be able to put the two together. And I suppose I very nearly did with the Ziggy character, but I had such short attention span and got disinterested so quickly after I'd created some kind of project that I wanted to move on. And I never really got the book together for the thing. So I had all the songs and the characters. But by the time we'd gotten it on the road and I'd been doing it for 18 months, oh, God, I couldn't wait to move on to something else.
So when you say you wanted to write musicals, did you want to write, like, Rodgers and Hart kind of musicals or Hair? I mean, what?
No, that was my point. No, yeah. My point was I wanted to rewrite how rock music was perceived.
Oh, I
and
see.
I
yeah,
thought
right.
that I could do some kind of vehicle involving rock musicals
right.
and presenting rock and characters and storyline in a completely different fashion.
Mm-hmm. So was singing something you started doing to come so that you could do that kind of theater?
It was. It was the conception that, I mean, God, I would love to have handed it on to somebody else, and I guess Ziggy would have been the perfect vehicle to have done with. I don't know why, to this day, I didn't find some other kid after I'd done it for like 6 months and said, here, I'll put the wig on and send him out and do the gigs, you know? I mean, it would have been much the best thing to do, and then I could have moved on quicker to something else. But that comes back to what I was saying. I needed to sing because nobody else was singing my songs.
Right.
So I had to do it myself.
You were briefly in a mime group before...
Yes, the Lindsay Kemp Mime Company.
Yeah, before becoming a solo musician.
Yeah. It all kind of ran... I tended to be... I seem to be kind of involved in so many things all at the same time, which is still how I kind of operate today. I can't keep my fingers out of any pies.
Well, are there things that you learned or became aware of through that mime group that you said, yeah, that I really like that, I'm going to work with that in my own performances?
I think everything that I learned about stagecraft and carrying through, creating a through point for a theatrical device. I think Lindsay Kemp really introduced me to the work of Jean Genet, and through that, I kind of kept re-educating myself about other prose writers and poets.
Mm-hmm.
He opened an awful lot of doors for me in terms of a new approach to what I could do. I could never have done what I did without being involved with Lindsay Kemp's company.
While we're on the subject of mime, I have to mention that in the Ziggy movie, you do those hands walking across the glass wall thing.
I know. That's my proudest moment of the Ziggy Stardust movie.
The dreaded mime thing.
Yeah. Well, meme over here, isn't it? I know. It's so utterly abhorred over here. We didn't know that in England because we love it over there. And it broke our hearts when we came over here and realized that memes were kind of... they're tantamount to some kind of artistic criminals.
David Bowie talking with Terry Gross. His new CD is called Reality. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. let's return to Terry's interview with David Bowie. One of his best-known albums, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, was re-released last year on its 30th anniversary. Let's hear the title track.
Now Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang, screwed up eyes and screwed down hairdo, like some cat from Japan. He could lick 'em by smiling, he could leave 'em to hang. They came on so loaded, man, well hung in snow white tan.
I'm going to ask you to describe creating the character, what you thought about when you were coming up with it, why you came up with it.
Well, I guess the simple one-liner is that myself and my mates and I guess a certain contingent of the musicians in London at the beginning of the 70s were fed up with Denim and the hippies. And I think we kind of wanted to go somewhere else. And some of us, I think, us more pompous, arty ones, probably probably read too much George Steiner and kind of got the idea that we were entering to this kind of post-culture age and that we better do something postmodernist quickly before somebody else did.
So did you see the kind of gender aspects of your performance, you know, dressing, you know, sometimes wearing an evening gown, sometimes, you know, often wearing lipstick, dyeing your hair, lots of eye makeup. Did you see the gender stuff as being a statement about postmodernism or a statement about sexuality?
Well, neither. I think they were just devices to create this new distancing from the subject matter. There was a kind of a diffidence, an idea that really hadn't been thought of before, that the history of rock could be recycled in a different way and brought back into focus without the luggage that comes along with it. It was a sense, a very strong sense of irony, I think, it became the foundation of two or three of us. I mean, I'm wary of the word glam because I think that became the all-inclusive term for any bloke with lipstick on, which is fine, you know, and that's what it is when it comes down to the public level. The public, obviously, they take things in a very simplistic fashion, and so they should. That's why we have such wonderful television. but I think that, as I say, that I guess it was, you know, kind of that art school kind of posturing that the Brits usually have. And it was, I guess, people like myself and Roxy Music that had a different agenda about taking up music. I think we all were kind of, well, maybe I can't speak for Roxy, of course, but some of us were failed artists or reluctant artists. You know, the choices were either, for most Brit musicians at that point, painting or making music. And I think we opted for music, one, because it was more exciting, two, you could actually earn a living at it. But I think we brought a lot of our sense, aesthetic sensibilities to it in terms of that we wanted to manufacture a new kind of vocabulary, a new kind of currency. And so the so-called gender bending, the picking up of maybe aspects of the avant-garde and aspects of, for me personally, things like the Kabuki Theatre in Japan, and German Expressionist movies and poetry by Baudelaire God, it's so long ago now. Everything from Presley to Edith Piaf went into this mix of this hybridization, this pluralism about what, in fact, rock music was and could become. That wasn't really a very simple answer to anything at all, was it?
No, but it was a good answer.
Well, it was a pudding, you know. It really was a pudding. It was a pudding of new ideas. And we were terribly excited. And I think we took it on our shoulders that we were creating the 21st century in 1971. That was the idea. And we wanted to just blast everything in the past, rather like the Vorticists did at the beginning of the century in Britain, or the Dadaists did in Europe. You know, it was the same sensibility of everything is rubbish and all rubbish is wonderful.
No, before you became David Bowie, when you were working, when you were playing with other bands before forming your own, did you do the denim thing? Do you know, did you wear a T-shirt and jeans on stage?
Very, very rarely, actually. No, it wasn't really something that I... Because I never believed it. It always felt like you were trying too hard to look like the audience or something. That whole thing about the artistic integrity, which, of course, I've never bought into with any artist. It's just not a real thing.
Wait, so let me stop you and see if I got this straight. Wearing a T-shirt and jeans seemed phony to you, but wearing mascara and eye makeup seemed right.
I didn't say that wearing a glamorization of the rock artist was any truer.
Oh, okay, right. It's artifice, but it's an artifice.
It's all artifice.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that okay, I think my main point would be is that the T-shirt and denims thing, in my mind, was also an artifice.
Right.
I didn't feel comfortable in that because I didn't feel like one of the working men. I mean, I could never be a blue-collary kind of Springsteen-y type artist because I don't believe I am that. I don't believe I could ever represent that. And it is merely representation.
Well, what was your family background?
I wonder. my father worked for a children's home called Dr. Bernardo's Homes. They're a charity.
I see.
He was a charity worker, in fact. My mother was a housewife. My father was from a farming family, agricultural family in the north of England. And my mother came from a very working class.
David Bowie's new CD, Reality, has just been released. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Time takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth. You pull on your finger, then another finger, then cigarette.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The March Up, Taking Baghdad with the 1st Marine Division by Bing West and Major General Ray L. Smith, retired. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There's blood on the coal.
Blood on the coal.
Coming up, Making a Mighty Wind. Harry Shearer tells us about writing some of the songs for the folk music mockumentary. He's currently on tour with the cast of A Mighty Wind. Also, David Edelstein reviews Anything Else, the new Woody Allen film. And we continue our conversation with David Bowie.
Listening, so he left the switch alone. Blood on the tracks, blood in the mine. Brothers and sisters, what a terrible time. Old 97 went in the wrong hole. Now in my number 60, there's blood on the coal. Well, the walls began to tremble, then the men began to yell. They could hear that lonesome whistle like an echo out of a well. They dropped their picks and shovels as to safety they did run, for to stay amongst the living in the year of 91. Blood on the tracks, blood in the mine. Brothers and sisters, what a terrible time. Old 97 went in the wrong hole. Now in my number 60, there's blood on the coal.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with David Bowie. He has a new album called Reality and is starting a world tour in connection with the CD. Before we get back to the interview, let's listen to one of his best-known songs. This is Fame.
lot of people, you had a period where drugs were a problem, and you once said that you feel like you have such an addictive personality, you even stay away from Tylenol or Advil. I'm wondering if you think that kind of addictive personality part of you has also influenced you as an artist, if you're equally kind of obsessive when it comes to writing music or recording or performing.
I think it does occupy a lot of my time in terms of, I think I have an abundantly healthy curiosity about life around me specifically, and how we put ourselves together culturally. And I think it served me well as an artist, in as much as I'm really inquiring continually into how things are made and why we make them, and the significance or meanings behind things. It will only be productive if there's an element of or some sense of cohesion or talent within the artists themselves. I mean, I know a lot of musicians and writers and painters that are completely obsessive and addicted to both drugs and what they do. Mm-hmm. And the ones who are good at what they do tend to produce good work, and the ones who don't, and maybe both will produce huge volumes of it.
You're a father now for the second time?
Yes.
And there's a difference of, I think, about 30 years between your first child's birth and your second. Is being a father now really different than it was the first time around?
Well, in as much as that I'm, of course, I was a young and ambitious artist when my son was born, and I think it took me on the road probably much too much, in as much that I really wasn't around as much as I should have been. But I think in the haze of being a really ambitious artist, I think you lose sight of those particular agendas, you know. At this time around, I suppose I was a lot more thoughtful before going into fatherhood, and I'm spending most of my time with my child.
Because rock and roll started as a youth music, everybody always wondered, well, will rock and roll continue to live, and what about the artists themselves? What about when they pass 30? What about when they pass 40 or when they pass 50? You're in your mid-50s now. Is that an issue for you? Do you feel like you have satisfactorily found a way to be a man in his mid-50s playing your music without feeling like what you're playing is... You know what I'm saying. That you're playing music that speaks to who you are and where you are now.
Having not really written any generational songs, I think maybe two or three of the songs that I've ever written have any bearing on the age of the listener. My stuff tends to be far more concerned with the spiritual and with subjects like isolation and being miserable. So I think that sort of touches on really any age group. So in my terms, they're just songs. The vehicle for those songs is a music that did indeed start as a youth culture music. But it is aged well in itself, and it has become a vast and complex thing now, with so many subdivisions and styles and variations. No, it's just what I do. I mean, I wouldn't know how to write and play any other kind of music, frankly.
David Bowie, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
David Bowie, speaking with Terry Gross last year. His new CD is called Reality. Here's the song, Never Get Old.
Better take care. Think about the guy, better get a room, better take care of me. I think about this and I think about personal history.
Better take care.
I breathe so deep when the movie gets real, when the star turns round.
Again.
Looks me in the eye, says he's got his mind on the countdown.
3, 2, 1.
Forever.
sweeter than they're gonna be living until the end of time. Forever. The sky splits over to a dull red skull. Head hangs low, cause it's all over now.
Coming up, satirist Harry Shearer. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross.
Local man, watching all the fish swim away. He no work, he just sleep and play. Sitting here on the sand.
Three folk music groups from the 60s reunite for a concert that will be broadcast live on public television. That's the premise of the satire A Mighty Wind, now out on DVD. The movie proved so appealing and successful that many of the film's performers subsequently went out on a live concert tour. Our guest Harry Shearer co-stars as the bass player and bass singer of the trio The Folksmen. The two other members of the group are played by Christopher Guest, who also directed and co-wrote the film, and Michael McKean. These three actors also starred in the heavy metal mockumentary This Is Spinal Tap. They first performed as the Folksmen 18 years ago and have even opened for Spinal Tap, delighting some people in the audience and confusing others. Here's a song from the soundtrack CD of A Mighty Wind, a song that isn't included in the film but which they perform on stage, the Folksmen's cover version of a Rolling Stones hit.
If you start me up, if you start me up, I'll never stop. If you start me up, if you start me up, I'll never stop. I've been running hard, you got me chicken, gonna blow my top. If you start me up, if you start me up, I'll never stop. You make a grown man cry. You make a grown man cry. You make a grown man cry.
Red off the oil, the gasoline. I walk smooth. She's a mean, mean machine.
If you start it up, kick on the starter, give it all you got.
When he's not playing a bizarre musician in the movies, Harry Shearer also does many of the voices on The Simpsons, including Mr. Burns, Smithers, and Ned Flanders. And he hosts Le Show, a public radio program of political and cultural satire. Terry Gross spoke with him recently and asked him what groups the Folksmen are modeled on.
The Folksmen is a trio. We're hirsute in all the wrong places. We fancy ourselves probably the most purist of the second or third wave of folk acts that actually hit the charts. Everybody in this film is of the era of folkies that actually were trying to make hit records as opposed to going down and recording field hollers in Alabama. So we look down on the probably on everybody else in this film. The obvious guess that most people make is Kingston Trio, but there's a little bit of Peter, Paul, and Mary in this. There's a little bit of Brothers Four, although we're missing a brother. Groups like that, you know, we're trying to straddle the line between good timey and no, we're really saying something, but of course we're really saying nothing, and it's not that good a time.
No. As you were saying, the Folksmen, think of themselves as like the non-commercial band, the more real folk band,
mm-hmm.
and they do.
And of course, the public agrees with them,
right? So I thought we'd play two versions of a song that you co-wrote called Never Did No Wanderin'.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have the Folksmen version, and then we'll have, like, the more commercial version.
the toothpaste commercial.
Yeah, the new Main Street Singers. But first, tell us the story of writing the song.
Well, the writing process was really, as every other part of the process of making this movie, totally different from the normal Hollywood scheme. Chris, being the director, didn't have a list of songs he needed and then call us up and just go, I need this, 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 and this, and we did it to order. We really were, like, kind of making up the songs based on what we thought, you know, groups needed and what was funny about this kind of folk music. So Michael McKean and I were at my house one day, and I dug up an old record of the Hootenanny program. It was a primetime series on ABC featuring folk music. That's how commercial it got. Hosted by that old folkie himself, Jack Linkletter. And we were listening to a track by, tell me how folky this group name sounds, The Yachtsman. And something in the song triggered us to start saying, you know, we need a song about rambling. Everybody's got a rambling song. We need, that's one of the great cliches of folk music, is rambling. I've been rambling. I've been going here and there. And I started doing a little bass riff, and Michael and I started playing, and then we just thought, you know, the comic twist on this is a guy who never did no rambling, never did no wandering.
Okay, which leads us right into the song. So first the Folksman version, the pure version, and then the commercial sellout version, the new Main Street Singers. And this is from the soundtrack of A Mighty Wind.
My mama was the cold north wind. My daddy was the son of a railroad man from west of hell, where the trains don't even run. Never heard the whistle of a southbound freight or the singing of its driving wheel. No, I never did no wandering. Never did no wandering. Never did no wandering after all. Wandering. Never did no wandering. My mother was the cold north wind. My daddy was the son of a railroad man from west of hell, where the trains don't even run. Never heard the whistle of a lonesome freight or the singing of his driving wheel. No, I never did no wandering. Never did no wandering. Never did no wandering after all.
That's two versions of Never Did No Wandering, co-written by my guest Harry Shearer, one of the stars of the new folk music mockumentary, A Mighty Wind. Did you ever go through a folk music period yourself?
Not really. Christopher played bluegrass as a youngster, which is, I guess, one of the purest forms of folk and or country music. It just really relies on very good playing. Among other things. But I remember this music sort of swirling around me when I was in college, but I was sort of a diehard Frank Ella Mel Torme guy, so I'd hear this music, and every once in a while I'd hear, like, a weird chord in a Kingston Trio song and go, they've been listening to the Hi-Los. But aside
right.
from that, you know, this wasn't my music.
Yeah, well, the new Main Street Singers have some very Hi-Los kind of harmonies.
Yes, they do. Well, John Michael Higgins, who performs as the leader of it and is also the vocal arranger of that, has that kind of ear. He grew up listening to, he said to me once, as the first person who ever said to me, his experience being the same as mine, I just listened to arrangements. If I heard a good arrangement, I didn't care what kind of music it was. So he has this ear for great arrangements, and he just throws all these sixth and seventh chords in where they don't belong, just for the fun of it.
Well, you weren't used to singing folk harmonies. I mean, that's not the kind of harmonies you'd sing in Spinal Tap.
No, but, you know, they're sort of in everybody's head, I guess, or at least they were in all of our heads. That wasn't nearly as much work as, you know, everybody in this movie, or almost everybody, either picked up a new instrument or had to relearn. Gene Levy hadn't played a guitar in 30 years. Higgins had never played a tenor guitar. Catherine O'Hara had never played the auto harp, and Parker Posey learned the mandolin for this movie, so there was a lot of picking and learning going on. And, you know, a lot of trust by Christopher to believe that everybody would, because he recorded the music live in the concert sequences, to believe that everybody would be ready on that day to be in concert form. It's emblematic of the trust he showed us all through the making of the picture.
Okay, time for another song. Here's another song by the Folksmen, and this is called Old Joe's Place, and this is the song that actually charted for them.
This is our hit. It got to number 17.
You co-wrote the song. Tell us about writing it.
This was, I think, one of the first Folksmen tunes we wrote when we did this piece on Saturday Night Live, and the premise was this washed-up folk group was, for some reason, getting a chance to appear on Saturday Night Live. And so you see them backstage before the show trying to decide whether they should do their Spanish Civil War song or some, you know, song about a real tragedy, a train wreck in a coal mine. You know, keep resisting the idea of doing the obvious song, which is the only one everybody's ever heard of us. And then, of course, we get on stage and do Old Joe's Place. So that was the gag. And it's a typical kind of good-timey folk song where every time the chorus comes around, it gets longer.
It struck me as very Burl Ives.
Yeah, I guess so. It's Burl something.
Okay, this is The Folksmen with my guest Harry Shearer, Old Joe's Place from the soundtrack of the folk mockumentary A Mighty Wind.
Whenever I'm out a-wandering, chasing a rainbow dream, I often stop and think about a place I've never seen.
Where friendly folks can gather and raise the rafters high,
with songs and tales of yesteryear until they say goodbye.
Well, there's a puppy
in the parlor and a skillet on the stove and a smelly old blanket that a Navajo wove. There's chicken on the table, but you gotta say grace. There's always something cooking at Old Joe's Place.
By around evening time, as soon as the sun goes down, some drop in from right next door and some from out of town.
Pick it.
Well, there's a
puppy in the parlor and a skillet on the stove and a smelly old blanket that'll never hold. There's popcorn in the popper and a porker in the pot. There's pie in the pantry and the coffee's always hot. There's chicken on the table, but you gotta say grace. There's always something cooking at Old Joe's Place.
That's Old Joe's Place with my guest Harry Shearer doing bass voice and playing bass as well. It's from the soundtrack of the film A Mighty Wind. What else did you listen to? You mentioned going back and watching old episodes of Hootenanny. But what else did you try to immerse yourself in to prepare for your role, to get into character?
We watched, there's a wonderful documentary about the Weavers, which focuses around a Weavers reunion. And since we were going to be reuniting after a long absence, we all looked at that as sort of a template for, you know, the behavior of these guys. I listened to a lot of, I sadly, in my extremely eclectic and never surrendered LP collection, have a lot of folk records that I'd never had occasion to listen to till now. For, you know, singing style and things like that. But in terms of character, it was, I did a little bit of research on guys in groups and just saw what their career trajectories were after the folk music scare, as Martin Mull calls it, evaporated, just to see, you know, how paths went before I kind of contributed my little bit as to what Mark Shubb, the character I play, what his life had been since the Folksmen broke up.
Well, Harry Shearer, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry, it's always a pleasure.
If you start me up, baby, start me up, I'll never stop. If you start me up, baby, start me up, I'll never stop. I've been running hot, you got me ticking, gonna blow my top. If you start me up, baby, start me up, I'll never stop. You make a dead man come, you make a dead man come. You make a dead man come. 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 Come. You make a dead man
come. Come by.
Harry Shearer spoke with Terry Gross earlier this year. A Mighty Wind will be out on DVD next week. Tonight, the cast begins a 4-day tour in Philadelphia, New York, Washington, D.C., and Boston. Coming up, a review of the new Woody Allen movie. This is Fresh Air. Another year, another Woody Allen movie. The director's newest comedy, his 33rd theatrical feature, is called Anything Else and stars Jason Biggs as a comedy writer learning the way of the world from a mentor played by Allen. The object of the younger writer's affection and his derangement is played by Christina Ricci. David Edelstein has this review.
After Woody Allen's last three unfunny comedies, I found myself in the bizarre position of hoping he'd make another heavy drama. Not out of longing for his lousy Ingmar Bergman imitations, but out of boredom with his lousy Woody Allen imitations. His newest movie, Anything Else, is another treadmill comedy, clearly churned out by someone who at this point is afraid not to write. It's a rehash of old themes, only even more vinegary than usual. It's misanthropic, misogynistic, and ugly. It's the reductio ad absurdum of Woody Allen relationship comedies. Every woman I know despises it, yet somehow I enjoyed it more than most of Allen's movies from the last decade. Anything Else feels driven in a way that those other films didn't. It's like a rant from a therapist's couch, angry, unmediated, free associational, unleavened by sentiment or compassion. And it's something else Allen hasn't been in a while. Funny. Imagine Annie Hall with the addition of a paranoid one-man Greek chorus, an aging comedy writer named Dave Dobell, played by Allen himself. Dobell is mentor to the movie's protagonist, Jerry Falk, played by Jason Biggs. On walks through Central Park, Dobell tells the ingenuous young comedy writer that Jerry's analyst is worthless and his agent a joke, that everyone hates the Jews, that he should own a Russian assault rifle for protection, and that there's no cosmic justice and no God. Dobell is obviously a frothing whack job, and by the end of the film, he's totally self-destructed. That said, Dobell is pretty much right about everything. He's especially right about the Annie Hall character, an aspiring actress named Amanda, played by Christina Ricci. Well, she's not a lovable, dingy neurotic like Annie. She's an insane, duplicitous narcissist with a mother played by Stockard Channing, who's even crazier. There's never a honeymoon in this movie. Almost from the start, Jerry and Amanda's courtship and romance are undercut by lies and delusions. And by the end, it's a mercy for Jerry to flee New York for L.A., which has to be a first in a Woody Allen movie. After Amanda stops having sex with Jerry, Dobell says it's obvious she's having an affair. He urges Jerry to tail her to her acting class, where, of course, Jerry sees what Dobell has told him he'll see.
What?
Yeah, that's right. I saw you.
How?
Well, I was spying on you.
You were spying?
Yeah, that's right. I saw the three of you. Yeah, you, your acting teacher, and your diaphragm. Your diaphragm, yeah, because it's not here. So where could it be? There's no such thing as a diaphragm repair shop.
Jerry.
I was there, Amanda. I saw it all.
Okay, I slept with Ron Keller. But I didn't do it because I care about him.
No? No, what then? To punish him?
No, I did it because I had to find out if there was something wrong with me. You know, because I can't sleep with you, with the person that I love. I had to know if I was some kind of freak or frigid. I had to know if I could even get aroused anymore and have an orgasm.
And can you?
Yeah, it's good news. I can.
A couple of years ago, Christina Ricci played Elizabeth Wurtzel in the still-unreleased film A Prozac Nation, and her Amanda seems deliriously pickled in Wurzel-esque self-absorption. Her face gets my vote as the most freakishly beautiful in movies. With that lollipop head and those pop-out eyes, she's like some Martian mad scientist version of a little girl temptress. It's a potent version, too. She's poison, but is there a man alive who wouldn't risk a sip or three? She's too much woman for Jason Biggs, who isn't very inventive here. He looks like the guy they'd focus the lights on while Adam Sandler is still in his trailer. But he does read his lines at the right quick tempo, and he gets his laughs. Alan stages most of the scenes at a frantic pace. The characters babble at each other. They're insanely oblivious to anyone else. And just when you think the picture can't get any busier, he throws in a split-screen phone call with more babbling lunatics on the other end. In one scene, some big thuggish guys steal a parking space from Dobell and then mock his righteous anger. As the shattered older man drives away, Jerry says that he and Dobell will have the last laugh, that they can now go to a deli and write a biting satire of those guys. And it's a mighty moment when Dobell turns the car around and whips out a crowbar. The whole movie feels like a crowbar coming down on everything Alan despises, which at this point must be pretty much everything. At times, it's a horrible spectacle, but his demolition timing, at least, is back.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, director Michael Winterbottom. His films include Wonderland, 24-Hour Party People, and Welcome to Sarajevo. His new film, In This World, is about two young Afghani refugees who travel 4,000 miles from Pakistan to London to claim asylum. Join us for the next Fresh Air.